Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. Joining us tonight, we have Fianna Fáil TD for Galway East and party spokesperson on Children and Youth Affairs, Anne Rabbitt, independent TD for Roscommon Galway, Dennis Nocton, Fine Gael senator and Shannon spokesperson on Agriculture, Food and Marine, Michelle Mulhern, Sinn Féin TD for Cork South Central, Donnacha O'Leary, and Colette Brown, barrister and columnist with the Irish Independent. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @LateDebateRTE. Now, housing remained on top of the political agenda today as Sinn Féin tabled its bill to propose to freeze rent for 3 years. The bill also proposes examining a tax credit for those struggling with high rents. The government is not supporting the bill today. The Taoiseach was once again responding to criticism about the 3,826 children currently living in emergency accommodation.
If we could do it quicker, if there was a cheque I could sign, if there was a button I could press, if there's a lever I could pull, we'd have done it by now. But our housing market was destroyed, our destruction industry was destroyed, our banks were bust and our government was bust. And we had a 7-year period when almost no homes were built in Ireland. During that period, 200,000 homes should have been built. And it is going to take us, and no matter what anyone may say, it is going to take us many years to recover from that.
The Taoiseach there on Leaders' Questions today. Donnacha O'Leary, the housing minister, I was watching the debate in the last couple of hours in the Dáil. Very robust contribution from the housing minister, Eoghan Murphy. He said the bill is reckless, it's unconstitutional, there is no evidence it will work. In fact, he cited the evidence of what's been happening in Berlin as evidence that it may well do a serious harm.
No, well, I don't accept that. Look, I mean, unconstitutionality is a thing that's easily thrown out there regularly by government ministers. He didn't produce any evidence of whether he even spoke to the Attorney General, not to mind any Attorney General use. Unconstitutionality was a point that was already made in relation to when the then Minister, Alan Kelly, was looking for rent pressure zones, or not that they were had that phrase at the time, but as it turned out, it was possible to legislate for rent pressure zones. So, like, I mean, the constitutional concerns that existed then evaporated when the government brought forward legislation. I think it'd be the same if they were to legislate for a rent freeze. The reason that a rent freeze is necessary, and look, I mean, I heard the Taoiseach there in that clip, is like, I mean, every response really in recent times to the housing crisis is the government appealing for more time. So they've had plenty of time. They've been in government since 2011. And like, I mean, Simon Coveney produced a policy document on how Fine Gael would manage the rent crisis when he was the minister. There's no progress made. Rents are rising. It's harder and harder to find a tenancy. And in that time, the average rent has increased from about just under €1,000 to €1,400, a little over that, and about €2,000 in Dublin. So people desperately need relief. I think we need a rent season. We need a rent relief.
But why is it taking so long for us to get to this point?
To get to this point in terms of the political consensus? Well, I'm not totally sure, to be honest with you. Like, I mean, a number of parties have supported this proposal for a period of time. Obviously, we brought forward this proposal. We were talking about it since about 2015, supported by Labour Party, Sock Dems, and I think perhaps the Green Party at similar policy. It's Fianna Fáil is the late conversion here, and it's unfortunate that they are the late conversion, because, as I say, if a rent freeze had been put in place 2-3 years ago, we wouldn't be looking at average rents the level that we are looking at.
Okay, I'll come back to you about the Berlin issue in a moment, because that is a serious issue that's been raised in relation to this move. But Anne Rabbitt, Fianna Fáil, very late to this party.
Well, perhaps or maybe not. Like Micheál, before this private members ever came in, Micheál actually signalled this 3 weeks ago on the floor.
Funnily enough, right before he was sending out people to knock on doors for the by-elections. Coincidentally.
Well, not necessarily, Katie. Like, we've been knocking on doors we haven't stopped knocking on doors since the last general election, to be quite honest with you. But we have tried every other option. We have given the government as much time as possible. And we are there at this point in time that there's no more time that can be given to the government. At the same time, there's 150,000 landlords. We've agreed to support the motion, the members' bill, at this moment in time, Donnacha, for the simple reason it's going to pre-legislative scrutiny. It will be totally and utterly scrutinised completely to see that it is constitutional and everything else.
But the option was open before now as well, of course.
Yeah, I was listening to your party housing spokesperson, Darragh O'Brien, very much sitting on the fence in this. we'll go along with this. We'll let you have your day. We'll let it go into the pre-legislative scrutiny. But there's a lot wrong with this, and we're only half supporting Sinn Féin in this.
Not necessarily.
Don't you want? You want to have it always, really?
Not at all. I think that's very disingenuous, to be quite honest with you. We don't want it always. What we want to do actually is to give relief to the person that's paying an average of €2,200 here in Dublin. We also
they would not be paying that, Anne Rabbitt, if he had gotten on board the rent freeze bandwagon 2 years ago. I mean, what has happened in the last 2 to 3 years has been
drive the private landlords completely out of the market, where we were bringing HAP on board and everything else. Like, in all fairness, we have 150,000 landlords who have only one or two houses there, and with the amount of regulations that's been foisted upon them for the last number of years, with bringing regulations up to standard, and I don't disagree with one bit.
So are you saying those landlords needed those rent increases?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
So what difference does it? What is the difference? No.
What I'm trying to say is we can't afford actually to drive people out of the market either, because they have provided an invaluable service of actually allowing housing there. Because you know what? When you go right across rural Ireland at this moment in time, there's an awful lot of closed up houses because people don't want to get into the market. They don't want to be part of this whole regulation and bureaucracy.
But listening to Lorcan Sir today, he was raising serious questions about this notion that there's been a flight from the market by the small landlords. And obviously, a lot of people who were accidental landlords would have, in the last number of years, come out of negative equity. So you could see why they would perhaps then at that point get out of the market, because they never intended to be landlords in the first place.
There is also a lot of landlords out there who are accidental landlords who aren't quite happy with the whole idea of actually dealing with county councils, dealing with HAP, and not knowing who the tenants might be coming into their properties or anything else like that. And we know that we've in excess of 8,000 houses that are not occupied at all in this whole country, and they could be used, but they don't want to use them.
Okay, Michelle.
Yeah. Sorry, firstly, can I say I listened to Dara O'Brien, the Fianna Fáil spokesperson this morning, and he was anything but convincing. And he did sound like he was trying to be politically opportunistic in relation to the issue to remove himself from supporting the Fine Gael minority government. And I have to say, Anne, and I respect Anne greatly, but Anne hasn't made any case here at all for a rent freeze. In fact, she's made the contrary. And I think there's two concerns in relation to the rent freeze. First of all is, yes, we're trying to not constrain in any way the number of houses available to the rental market. And equally, we're trying not to discourage investors or people who would be interested in building properties. And talking about Berlin, we know that that is what happened in Berlin, that year on year from 2018 to 2019 or whatever calendar year it was, permits or planning permissions for new houses, new
building permits,
dropped by 40%. Now, can I also say the data around landlords withdrawing is provided by the Residential Tenancies Board, and they equally expressed concern about a rent freeze.
But can I put you, Michelle, Mulhern, that one of the big issues that landlords, particularly small landlords, people with one property or two property, and some of which, as we say, probably never intended to be a landlord in the first place, one of the big issues they have is that they're paying 50%, 52% tax on that their rental income is treated as all other income, and there isn't tax arrangements available to them that we know are available to the big corporate landlords. And surely that's, if you're worried and concerned about landlords fleeing the market, surely that's an area you should be looking at rather than shooting down ideas by other parties.
Well, I think they are two separate issues, because we know that there are
how are they separate issues?
Well, they're separate issues in the sense that the impact that a rent freeze might have on the market that we're trying to stimulate in terms of availability of rental property, new builds for both purchase and rent, and also, of course,
Michelle,
get rid
really
of vacant houses.
The fact that you
but
weren't building enough
tax
houses
break,
for the last number of years.
But sure, who collapsed the market, Anne, now, in fairness?
Do you know,
can
you've
just
had
go back
to 8 years now
breaks?
To deal with
can
it?
Can I go back to briefly to the tax breaks? I would agree with you, Katie, but I would say politically, and in terms of a populist view, there's never sympathy for landlords in that regard, no matter what Anne has said there.
But is that the problem? Is that politically, it's not politically an easy hit to support landlords in that way, and therefore we just plough on.
Landlords are paying income tax. They pay USC, they pay PRSI, they get nothing for the PRSI they pay, and they get no deduction for local property tax. So if I had a commercial property and I'm paying commercial rates on it, I'll get a deduction. You won't get it if you're if it's a private residential.
You are correctly identifying the problem.
How come we
are in this situation? Surely, then people are out there looking at 80% increases in their rent over recent years.
More than 80%.
More than 80%.
It's doubled in Dublin, and it's gone up 125% in Dublin.
To be sitting in the studio as part of the party of government and to be outlining the situation that landlords find themselves in, which is clearly contributing to the problem, and to say, well, isn't this terrible?
When government moves to rightly respect the constitution and property rights, and it was right in relation to
the common good, Michelle?
Of course, but there's also proportionality, Colette, and that's where the debate has to come in as regards our constitution. And I've heard landlord representatives on, including this morning with the speaker from Threshold on, I've never ever heard anybody put any sort of case to the landlords, well, are you under pressure here? Landlords are hammered all the time. They're hammered in the media, they're hammered in the public discord, and they're hammered within in Dáil Éireann all the time. And any time anybody attempts to stand up in relation to and respect our constitution, and yes, get a balance in relation, but none of that wants to be heard. We have a constitution that we subscribe to sometimes when it suits, as far as I can see.
So landlords are the people being hammered in this?
No. I'm talking about in the round.
I'm talking about in the round.
You brought up the issue of the taxes on landlords, and rightly so, because it is a consideration.
You're a member
of the party of government, Michelle. So if you're so concerned about the tax treatment of landlords, why has the government done absolutely nothing in that regard over the last number of years? You come in here this evening, there's a bill that's specifically related to trying to alleviate some of the massive, massive pressure that is on people who are renting across Ireland, and you instead devote a 10-minute soliloquy to the plight of landlords when you're in government and your party could have done something in relation to all of the items that you mentioned over the last 10 minutes.
Well, hold on, Colette. The question was put to me and I answered the question in relation to landlords, and it was rightly raised.
The
government has initiatives in relation to repair and lease, buy and renew, which is targeted at people with properties and giving funding to them to bring vacant properties back into use to create situations where we have landlords. So action has been taken to encourage people into landlordism so that people will have places to live. So it's, you know, there's a round and there's many players in this situation, and we just touched on one, and that's all.
Who is renting here?
I'm renting.
Oh, we've three. We've a majority of renters,
and I'm a renter, and I don't bash landlords. I have a landlord. I get on very well with my landlord. My landlord actually didn't put up the rent this year, so it's not obligatory for landlords to put up rent. And I think what the problem is that the 4%, the rent pressure zone, it's seen by some who are renting to people as a target that has to be met every year, rather than something that maybe they can or they cannot put a price that they can put the rent up to.
Because of course we all know that what happens is if you miss your deadline this year and next year, and then you want to say move out of that property, you are then penalised in terms of...
Well, let's remember that the rent pressure zones are temporary. What Sinn Féin are talking about doing is a temporary measure, and it's a temporary measure to give people some breathing room. And the government, for years and years and years, we've been talking about supply. We need supply. And what would a three-year rent freeze allow the government to do? Provide some supply to alleviate the pressure.
Why isn't the spokesperson for Threshold for it? Why is the Residential Tenancies Board reservations about a rent freeze?
What are we actually talking about in a rent freeze? So, I mean, people are talking about, like, you know, it's communism and, you know, a theft of property rights and, you know, you man the barricades kind of a thing. We're talking about people not being able to potentially put up rent by a grand total of 12% because the rent pressure zones now, because the market is in such crisis, it covers almost the entirety of the country. So we're talking about an increase that will not go ahead potentially of up to 12%. That's it.
Well, Dennis Nocton, you supported the government and in both the confidence motions against Eoghan Murphy. What would it take for you not to support the government?
Well, can I deal with the issue that's before us here today, first of all? And can I say that the rent freeze and the issue of taxation of landlords is the opposite sides of the same coin?
Where do you stand on the rent freeze itself?
Well, I actually spoke in the Dáil tonight on it. And the point that I made tonight in the Dáil is you can actually deal with both of those issues. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. All we have to do is to look what goes on in the Department of Agriculture in terms of long-term leasing of land. So back, if you go back, and I made the point tonight that when Owen Murphy started in secondary school, traditionally, land in Ireland was leased for 11 months and that caused huge problems, and the rent was reviewed every 11 months. With a lot of rental property, it's every 12 months. But now, today, about 50% of land is leased for a minimum of 5 years. The price is fixed at the start of that lease. Some of that land is leased for up to 15 years at a fixed rate per annum. So you can bring around about a rent freeze, not just for 3 years, but for 5 years and potentially up to 15 years. And at the same time, there's an incentive, tax incentive provided to farmers who enter into those long-term leases. So what
I've
said...
And can I just ask you, when that was introduced, was the issue of constitutionality of that move raised or...
Oh, absolutely. It's not a constitutional issue and has been done on quite a number of occasions, has been altered in the finance bills. And as a minister in cabinet, I put this proposal forward. As a member of the opposition, I put this specific proposal forward because I feel what we need to get away from and what I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis is families where their rent is going up or they're being given notice to leave and there isn't accommodation for them to go into. Exactly. Now, if we can provide
When did you raise this at Cabinet?
Families with 5, 10 and 15 year leases, you're guaranteeing them security of tenure in relation to it and an agreed price of the cost of their accommodation over that period of time. In relation to it, I have raised this consistently when I was in Cabinet.
What was the response to it?
I raised it in the context of the Finance Bill and put down an amendment to it with the Minister for Finance. And the Minister for Finance told me that this issue was looked at and it would cost too much to introduce it. And he forwarded me on a copy of the report that was completed on it. I went through the report and the report makes no reference to this issue at all. I took it up with Minister Owen Murphy and Minister Owen Murphy believed that this had been considered by finance and it hasn't been considered by finance. So I intend now to go back, and that's the point I was making tonight.
Which finance minister are we talking about?
The current finance minister.
So Pascal Donoghue told you that this had been considered in the report that was done in relation to the rental market.
Yeah.
And you're saying that there was no reference to it whatsoever in the report?
No, there was no reference to it in the report whatsoever.
And when you had that discussion with Pascal Donoghue, did you point that out to him?
Well, I haven't had that discussion with Pascal Donoghue. This was raised at committee stage of the bill a couple of weeks ago. I have taken this up subsequently with Owen Murphy and Owen Murphy is committed now to taking this up directly with the Minister for Finance.
Just go back one step. You said when you were actually sitting at the cabinet table yourself, which isn't that long ago, Dennis Nocton, what was the response to your cabinet? Because you were one of the team then.
Yeah,
you were inside
absolutely.
The tent.
Absolutely. And the Minister for Housing and the Minister for Finance both believe that this issue had been reviewed by their officials, and clearly it hasn't been. And I believe that this is a mechanism to do what Dunica is talking about in relation to a rent freeze, but do it for far longer than 3 years, as well as do what Michelle is talking about, giving a break to landlords. And I think really this needs to be focused on the small landlords. The corporates and the multinationals don't need this break. But this is a way to actually bring Sinn Féin thinking and Fine Gael thinking together. And that was the point I made on the floor of the Dáil tonight.
Donica.
I'd have to look at that proposal in detail, but it could be a few things. It could be long-term private leasing. It could be long-term leasing by the public of private land, or it could be long-term leasing by social housing or people who are seeking housing on public land. If it's the third, then that's great. if it's the second, then that's RAS. We've had RAS, and RAS didn't work. The problem with RAS was, if it's the first, well, like, I mean, look, that's a contract between a private individual and a private landlord, and there's no way that you can really. But if you
no, but if you, no, but no, 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 you're missing this the key point.
This happens today. This happens today. Tomorrow morning, farmers will sign a lease, and there is a tax incentive there.
I understand.
And the farmer that's leasing that land knows for the next 15 years how much he will pay for that in rent every year. Why can we not do it for houses if we can do it for farmland?
The reason it is done for farmers is so is that they actually, that if they're borrowing from the bank, that they know that what precisely what they're paying for the next number of years. That is exactly why that was brought in at the time. So as there could be stability in what their repayment capacity was.
And we need stability in the housing market.
And why wouldn't it work for housing?
I'm not saying it wouldn't work for housing.
Do you think it would work for housing?
I do actually. I think actually it's like the cost rental model. Is it not, Dunica? Well, that whole idea, that idea where you could build housing on state-owned land, where you then could, when they're built, when that
I don't think that is what Dennis is talking about.
What I'm talking about is any rental property.
Absolutely, I have no problem.
It doesn't make any difference on what site it's built on. What I'm dealing with in my constituency at the moment is families coming in to me. The landlord has given them notice to leave,
exactly,
and the difficulty is in the town of Athlone or the town of Bannisloe. Tomorrow morning, there's probably four houses to rent.
Yeah.
And they're outside of any rental limits that anyone can afford
to pay.
And
that's what I was saying 5 minutes ago.
Can we not try and keep people in the house they're in rather than having to go in a panic trying to get housing?
Absolutely. I'm not for that, but like, I mean, look, I'm not sure. Like, listen, if you're asking people, it's perfectly open for a private tenant and a private landlord to enter into a 5 or 10 year agreement.
But why would they do it, Dunica?
Well,
why would they do it?
Well, why would they? Reason that they don't do it is because it's in the interest of the landlord, to be honest. And I'm not hitting on landlords, but this is the reality of the market. It's a very profitable market. Rents are at record levels. Why would they enter into tying their hands when rent could increase?
Here's Doherty
has never objected to the long-term leasing of land and the tax incentive that is there for farmers to lease out land on long-term lease.
Yeah,
why would Sinn Féin object to the same model being used to provide security of tenure for up to 15 years for people in rental accommodation?
To be honest, I'm not objecting as such, and I'm trying to understand it. I didn't hear you on the floor earlier, but... Like, I mean, I suppose my concern is that if it's anything like the RAS scheme, the problem with the RAS scheme was it looked very attractive at the time that it came in. It was a long-term lease between the local authority, between the private homeowner, the person who owned the property, and the tenant. It looked attractive, it was a long-term lease. The problem was the bottom fell out of the economy, so people got into financial difficulties, and rent became more attractive because it kept on increasing. So landlords broke their contracts with the local authority, with the tenant. People ended up out on their ear, and people who had been previously told that they'd be treated as local authority tenants and kept in tenancies, the local authority didn't accommodate. RAS was a bad scheme. It didn't work. If it's anything like that,
But given the way that rents have been going, I heard the minister in the Dáil making a big song and dance about the fact that latest Daft survey shows that rent inflation is slowing down. We're going to make the point that slowing down is down to 5 or 6% per annum, which is completely unacceptable if you're at the level that most people are now at with their rental payments.
Exactly.
But I'm saying, is the issue perhaps that the level of tax break you'd have to offer to compensate landlords for offering very long leases would be exorbitant in terms of the public purse?
No, I don't think so. And like, this could easily be phased in. You could do it with a landlord with one or two properties and see how it works in relation to that. Like, this was phased in terms of agriculture and has worked very successfully. So like, if it has worked in one sector of the economy, why is it not worth trying it in another sector of the economy?
And the positive of it, Dennis, I actually think there's merit in what Dennis is saying here tonight, because the other side of this is, if we don't address it this way, HAP will continue to go up and go up and go up. So you may as well be addressing the increase on the HAP maybe by passing it on the other side, so as we can actually cool it off a little bit.
We've got Fianna Fáil on board. Sinn Féin is thinking about it. Fine Gael, what do you think, Michelle? We can sort this out tonight.
I suppose I'm on the same page as Sinn Féin in the sense that I'm trying to understand exactly what he's saying. Well, no rent review in a long lease, is that basically what you're saying?
To give you maybe some assistance in relation to it, Michelle, neither the Minister for Finance nor the Minister for Housing, when I originally raised it with them, had any issue with it, and the Minister for Housing was surprised that this hadn't been considered by the Department of Finance.
Okay, I want to move on before I go. I asked you at the start of this, you've supported the government through both the confidence motions and I think right through any of those key. Are you going to continue to do so?
Well, look, as I've said since I left government, I will deal with this on a case-by-case basis.
You haven't come across a case yet where you haven't supported them?
No, that's not the case. In fact, if you look at my voting record in the Dáil, about 50-60% of the time I vote against the government.
But in the key ones where they need you in there?
Not necessarily. I've put forward amendments that have been voted on in the Dáil and been accepted by the opposition. So, that's not the case.
Can I make one two-line point about the DAFT.ie report, because the Minister loves quoting selectively from it in relation to the level of rental increases beginning to slow down marginally. What he doesn't ever talk about is what Ronan Lyon says in his introduction to the report, which says that he highlighted the emerging shortage of housing supply in 2009, and he said the trends were not difficult to spot back then. And he has also said that even if the rental increases begin to slow down, unless the supply is dealt with, and we saw today 34,000 housing units needed every year, nowhere near what the government is supplying, that we're looking into another 10 years of extremely high rents.
I mean, I just think people out there must be terrified by this, because it just seems to be a spiral that is... I mean, how high is too high, Michelle? How high will we allow rents to go before some massive emergency political action will have to be taken?
Look, it's very critical, and I mean, people are in a very difficult situation. In fact, younger people starting out in their careers and that, it's hard to know how they can live in Dublin and manage with rents and everything. So, I mean, there's no denying that. The issues are around supply. We all know that. And that is the concern of government, that a rent freeze measure would impact upon supply based on evidence, but as I mentioned earlier, I don't want to go over it again. The Residential Tenancies Board have indicated concerns, and Threshold weren't that enamoured that I heard this morning about it.
I did hear Mark from Threshold this morning, and he could have said
this is the way to go, but he didn't.
He didn't say it wasn't the way to go either. Yeah.
Well, even Darragh O'Brien had his reservations about it. So, you know, it's not clear cut as presented.
The Sinn Féin bill, rather.
Okay, I want to move on.
That's an assumption.
Just a couple of texts on this before we leave it. Why are Sinn Féin calling for tax relief for renters and not for mortgage holders? Holders paying the highest interest rates in the EU, do they not need help too? It's time that politicians of all parties ceased objecting to new residential planning applications. That's another night's work. We've touched on it in the studio many times before. They're all at it. Hounding landlords is only forcing them to flee the market. We need to build new houses. No other way to address the shortage. That's from Larry Dunn in Rosslare. Have we any evidence, please, from Sinn Féin? Give us an example where rent freezes have worked, says Andrew Murphy. And if we have a constitution which makes rent limitations impossible, then we must accept that James Connolly died for nothing. And we leave that one there. I want to move on, because a really, really serious story emerged today. This was the report from Safe Ireland, which revealed that victims of domestic violence had to be turned away from refuges over 3,000 times in 2018 because those services were full. And more than 10,000 women and 2,500 children received help from a domestic violence support service last year. Katrina Gleeson of Safe Ireland was speaking to Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland this morning.
The budget allocation for these services this year was something over 25 million. That was an increase, the government says, of 1.5 million on the previous year, but you say it falls short.
Well, it wasn't an increase, Brian, and I think that's what we're looking at, empty promises and recycled budgets, and these will not respond to the needs of women and children. So there was no increase, and I think it's really important to understand that. There was a spin when we called out the government at the budget announcement, because we were incredibly disappointed that there was no money increased. And so what we're talking about is the sustainability of a very fragile sector.
And that was Katrina Gleeson of Safe Ireland. Michelle, she was clearly stating there that Fine Gael is spinning this issue, this really serious issue. Is that not shameful?
Well, look, I don't think that Fine Gael can be accused or the government can be accused of not thinking or thinking that this issue is anything but very serious. Women and children are our most vulnerable, and we know in the extreme it goes beyond domestic violence. We see fatalities. We see women dying at the hands of people they know, partners, etc. I mean, a lot of legislation, a lot of work has been done. Legislation brought in relation to issues like coercive control. Funding was mentioned there. There's further funding, I am told, for Budget 2020 in relation to victim support services, 1.8 million. And I mean, I would equally say that in relation to our criminal justice system, that compared to a few short years ago, the way that domestic violence issues and sexual violence against women, and of course it just doesn't happen to women, but across the board, that it is more tailor-made and more sympathetic to the victims, and that's the way we should be driving it.
And I think, to be fair, Safe Ireland have acknowledged that, and they have welcomed the new domestic violence legislation, and they have welcomed the ratification of the Istanbul Convention on International Women's Day. But they say that it is just unacceptable. You are leaving the situation where the figure for in the budget last year was 25 million for all the support services for this extraordinarily vulnerable sector, particularly in a housing crisis where women of any situation will be hard pressed to go. But can you imagine going to the door of a woman's refuge with your children in this scenario and being turned away?
Equally, can I just say this? And I won't argue with that, because this is when people need help. But I think it's quite shocking when we see the figures of women that are driven in the direction of needing help, and the escalation, it would seem. And equally,
is it not more shocking that we don't have those services in place for them, knowing what we know about the numbers and how far behind we are in terms of providing these services, that we don't even respond in the most basic way to those needs?
Well, in fairness, yes, you have pointed out the cases that were not where services were not available. And personally, I wouldn't think that's acceptable. And yes, more funding is required. But a lot of people were helped and services provided. And unfortunately, that amounted to 10,000 women and 2,500 children in our country last year. And there's an issue, and there's an issue beyond just the response to it. And of course, when there's emergency, we have to respond. When people feel they have to leave their homes because they're unsafe, we have to respond. But there's a bigger issue around violence towards women. And it doesn't seem to be better it's getting, notwithstanding the advances that we have made in our society in relation to the position of women. And this is a serious issue that has to be tackled.
Are you not embarrassed, Michelle Mulhern, tonight to be in the studio talking about the serious issue of violence against women in the context of what Catriona Gleeson said today of the government lack of support for these services?
No, but totally. Personally, I'm not. No, Katie, because in relation to the issue, I have zero tolerance for the issue. And in relation to anybody that needs assistance, they should get assistance. So the issue needs to be addressed clearly. It's black and white like that. And the funding is insufficient and women need more assistance in the context also, as you said, is that there's a housing shortage. Then quite simply, it has to be addressed. My point is, not taken from that, my point is that we seriously have to look at why the problem is escalating, or we can imagine that people are reporting these things more, that they're not tolerating abusive
situations.
Well,
I'm not going to lay that at the door of the government, Michelle Mulhern, but clearly
it's a societal issue.
Anne Rabbit.
The reason that actually the numbers are going on up and gone up, Michelle, is because actually good legislation has come in. It's more topical. People are talking more about it, and women can be
comfortable. Which government have been involved in.
Yes. But the point I was going to make a few moments ago was, like, we have only 141 refuge spaces in the entire country. Minimum we need is 472, but at the same time, 3,500 were turned away in 2018. When Simon Coveney was the Minister for Housing at that point in time, when they did the housing bill, there was not one room laid out for Galway County, the size of it, not one. And actually, the following budget, we managed to get 8 rooms, and they're still shaking the bucket cope inside in Galway trying to put on rooms. That's not good enough in this day and age. There's 11 counties where there isn't one refuge room for women fleeing from domestic violence or coercive violence. It's wrong, Michelle.
Dennis.
Yeah, look, the situation is that any victim of domestic violence should not be turned away, because when they're turned away, you're putting them at risk again of that abuse. You're also maybe
forcing them back into that situation again. Because, you know, for a victim to come forward and take that step to leave with their children out of a house, you know, is a very difficult step for them to take. And for them to seek that help and the door not to be open for them, you know, is leaving them in an extremely vulnerable situation. And no individual should be left in that. No family and no woman should be left in that situation. And it is a bigger part of the housing crisis, because what we should have is homes across the country that can be used for that purpose, not specifically designated, because the last thing you need is the perpetrator knowing, well, that's the designated house, and if I go there, the chances are that my spouse will be there.
Yeah. Dunnock, I wanted to raise with you a story that was in the Examiner today. The Protective Services Unit for the Cork City Garda Division has closed investigations into new cases since November 2017 because it doesn't have the resources.
I actually raised this at a joint policing committee in Cork on Monday a week ago in relation to Protective Services Unit. Like, I mean, I suppose when that was announced, there was a lot of fanfare, and there was I suppose the ambition was that they would handle all sexual offences in the Cork City area. Not only is it the case that that's not happening, but they have closed, I suppose, taking on new cases. So clearly under-resourced. There's an issue in relation to the West Cork Protective Services Unit in terms of their facilities. I don't think they have a place to locate at the minute. It is a good idea to have a unit like this. It makes sense to, I suppose, gather all your staff that have experience and an expertise in it. But if it's not going to be properly resourced, then you have a major problem. In relation to the refugees, like, it's obviously positive that we've signed the Istanbul Convention, but like, we're in breach of it. We're in breach of it due to our lack of shelter spaces, and that's a clear fact. And there's a bit of, you referenced there, people saying that the government are spinning. Well, Tuzla are spinning as well. Like, Tuzla is saying that it's one space for every 10,000, or at least were saying one space for every 10,000 people was adequate. For every 10,000 women at risk of domestic violence was adequate. The Istanbul, it's 10,000 per person.
Yeah.
And Dennis makes a very accurate point. Like, it takes so much to take that first step to look for help, because it's such a frightening experience, I must imagine. Like, you know, to go looking for help and then to be turned away from it is appalling.
And then to the next step of this, and this is another story that we were looking at today, because this campaign has been launched, Courting Disaster, to have adequate facilities for the family court. And of course, a lot of abuse victims end up in these situations with the family court. Tell us what the family court is like, Colette.
Well, and anyone who goes to the family court will see that there's just it's a small little foyer inside in a nondescript building. There's four courts that lead off the foyer. And the thing is that because family law proceedings are held in camera, everybody has to wait in the foyer until they're called to go in for their case. So what you have basically is you've got a throng of people. You've got lawyers, barristers. They have nowhere private to consult with their clients, to get instructions from their clients. You have women who are possibly the victims of domestic violence having to stand within inches of the people who are, you know, accused of abusing them. You've got children who are brought into that situation. The attention is heavy in the air sometimes. I mean, it's just completely inadequate. The then Chief Justice in 2014 went down to the site in Smithfield where this new courts complex, which was supposed to completely renovate the way that these cases are handled. It's supposed to be a state-of-the-art kind of complex which would bring in family law and children's courts. The site was identified. The then Chief Justice went down in 2014, and since then there's been absolutely no progress, and it seems the Department of Justice seems to have lost all interest in it. There's a fight going on between the Department of Justice and the Court Service at the moment. The Department of Justice say they've got 80 million. The Court Service say it's going to cost at least 140 million. The Department of Justice don't seem to want to cough up the money in the middle, the 50 million, the 60 million, which seems hard to understand when you consider all the money that's been spent on the Children's Hospital, all the money that goes into broadband schemes, all the money that goes into practically everything in this country. This is a courts complex that is going to do the country for decades to come. It's going to cost 4 or 5 years to build. There's a site ready to go. It's desperately needed. Everybody admits that it's desperately needed, but there doesn't seem to be any willingness to get the show on the road.
Okay, just very, very quickly, because we have to go to...
There is another issue as well. At least you have a dedicated court service here in Dublin. Yes. If you're unfortunate to be outside of Dublin, then you don't have that. You're going through the district court and the circuit court system, where Those victims of domestic violence, those children, are inside in the lobby with the ordinary run-of-the-mill cases. So we really need a dedicated family court across this country.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, I might just say 2 points. First of all, I practiced myself as a general practice solicitor in a rural area, and really a courthouse in Dublin isn't going to help all the courthouses around the country. So you're very right. And I mean, they're inadequate even in relation to all sorts of, even your basic criminal district court prosecution, they're inadequate and they need more investment. But I can say that Minister Flanagan is bringing forward a scheme of a bill in relation to the establishment, particularly of a family law court, because the fact that it's in camera, as Colette has described, means that the issue of precedent and consistency in relation to judgments, and I know advances have been made on that in recent times, but going back a number of years ago, I could be in a family law court and it seemed to be very subjective to the particular judge and his view about, and especially when you have people who weren't married to each other, etc. And that's not that long ago. So there needs to be more consistency, and I think because of the sensitivities around family law and the natural way our court system is, which is adversarial, we need to sort of pull that out of it and try and relax things more for people. But it does require investment, as do so many of the things we've discussed here tonight. But he has indicated that he's bringing forward this scheme as regards legislation shortly.
But not the extra funding that the court service says they require.
And also facilities, etc. But you're talking about going around the whole country, because there are inadequacies in so many parts of the country.
Okay. Well, if I can just say that the court in Dublin is going to comprise 22 district courts, circuit courts and high courts, mediation service, there's going to be a children's court. I fully understand that and fully accept that, but it is desperately needed in the capital city.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break there, but stay with us because we're going to be talking about RTE and Smoky Coal after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back. In studio tonight we have Anne Rabbit, Michelle Mulhern, Donal O'Leary, Dennis Nocton and Colette Brown with the Irish Independent. Now, Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin today accused the government of ducking and diving and a failure of backbone for delaying the introduction of a nationwide ban on smoky coal. Dennis Nocton, how long ago was it that you promised us we'd have a nationwide ban on smoky coal?
The ban on smoky coal was to come in its totality from the 1st of September of this year. It was to be phased in from the 1st of September of 2018. That was the plan in relation to it. And the legislation was ready to sign the ministerial order with regard to that. And then there was legal documentation that came, legal challenges from a number of operators. And at that stage, the officials were giving me advice in relation to it. I made it clear and I told them to instruct the industry that I was determined to go ahead with it. We needed to look at maybe looking at alternatives, because the risk was that if we proceeded along the route that we were planning at the time, you could end up in a situation where the smoky coal ban in the cities that was already in place could be undermined.
So this is because there's been new evidence that briquettes and turf and wood are also damaging to people's health. And the legal challenge was, why are you banning smoky coal unfairly when all these other products are equally damaging?
Yes, but the basis for the legislation that was brought forward and the nationwide ban was a joint North-South Ministerial Council report that was published by my predecessor, Alan Kelly. And it had looked at air quality between 2000 and 2013. And had seen that there was a 50% increase in the use of coal and the impact of coal in terms of air quality. In terms of peat, there was actually a 27% reduction, and the data was inconclusive in relation to wood.
Okay, so the legal threats came in, yeah. And was your advice that those legal threats, if they had been actioned, would be successful?
The advice that I had received was that if they were successful, that it could bring down
the existing ban in Dublin.
The existing.
Well, what I don't understand is why if there is a good case to be made there, why aren't they suing in relation to the ban in Dublin?
Yes, and you're right in relation to that. And that ban is there since Mary Harney
introduced
it.
In the 80s.
And the
argument that I had made with my officials was that, remember that the basis for this was different than the original smoky coal ban. The legal basis for it was different. Mm-hmm. So what I had asked my officials to go back and do was to, on the basis the evidence was there, proceed with the smoky coal ban. It may require an alteration to the regulation that it was going to bring in, but to proceed with that.
But if the evidence has now been produced that turf and the other products we were building, are you saying there isn't evidence that briquettes and turf cause lung damage?
Let me clarify that, yes, the evidence is there in relation to the amount of particulates of dust, very fine dust, that would come off peat and high moisture content timber. But there is not the evidence there to say that that is a contributing factor to the poor air quality in Ireland. And that was the evidence that's missing. The evidence is there in relation to coal. And remember that the intention was here to change the fuel, not change the heating systems. What Richard Bruton is now proposing
I thought the intention was to improve people's health.
Yes, but it was to improve people's health through changing the fuel, not changing the heating systems. Like if you go into many parts of the Midlands of Ireland, 40% of heat is coming from peat.
I was going to say, as a minister, you were never going to be going to propose a ban of burning.
No, but and actually I did.
Were you?
Because I was the one that proposed in Project Ireland 2040 that we would phase out all dirty fossil fuels between now and 2035. And the funding was put in place to allow for the retrofitting.
But even for, you're saying even for domestic burning of turf?
For the retrofitting of all homes. Remember, new homes today no longer have fireplaces. Mm-hmm. So this was transitioning anyway. And the statistics and data that was presented to me was shown that there was a reduction in the amount of peat being used by 27% between 2000 and 2013. So people are naturally moving away from that anyway. And I don't think there is a need to force that. The issue is in relation to coal, and that should have proceeded. And that was my intention.
And it still should proceed. Yeah. And it still should proceed in relation to the air quality and in relation to coal.
But you accept that there's a possibility and a risk that we might be putting the current smoky coal ban in Dublin at risk?
Well, the other alternative then, Katie, is what do? We abandon all usage of fossil fuels right throughout the country just because the big operators say, actually, we're going to challenge you on this. I think if that's the case, then let them challenge because they haven't done it year to date.
And in fairness now, it wasn't the big operators here. All of the operators here were at one. They were supportive of the introduction of the smoky coal ban. But the legal basis...
So who was threatening then?
It was companies from outside this jurisdiction. Yes.
Okay. Michelle, where do we stand with this now?
Okay, well, I think that there's two aspects to it. You're talking about the air quality and people's health, which is very important. And then there's the climate action piece as well, where we're trying to reduce carbon emissions and policy, the way policy is going and how we should and ought to be heating our homes in the new passive homes that are being built means that we're not reliant on fossil fuels. But the reality is that up until very recently, the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland were giving grants for people to upgrade their oil boilers. And I raise this loads of times. Even the local authorities, which have refurbished their housing stock to bring them up to standard, to make them more energy efficient and put in heating systems, it's oil-fired central heating they put in. So I think any time we're talking...
I was the minister that changed that.
Well, in any event, up until very recently, that has been the case, and incorrectly so, in my view, because this is obviously going on for a while. I've raised it. But if we're going to be doing something that might impact on people who rely on turf domestically cut, because the real offenders in relation to turf cutting as regards the scale of it that has an impact has been Bord na Mona and ESB, not the person going out cutting for themselves or as opposed to people doing it commercially. So I think we have to protect people because there's a lot of vulnerable people who have no money to change heating systems.
Absolutely.
And if we're really talking about just transition, this is when the rubber hits the road, because you're quite right, we should keep aspiring, but we have to check where people are at or there'll be a revolution in the country, and we have to try and bring people with us too. So as regards turf, I think that, you know, there's room to how will I put it?
That balance.
Balance, exactly.
But should we not look at it like the smoking ban? That public health should come first. And as you know, even though it may financially or socially inconvenience people.
But Katie, the reality...
Socially, it's financially. No, I just said
financially.
Katie, as someone that has gone through turf bans in this country and experienced it firsthand, the reality is that the amount of peat and turf that is being burned in domestic fireplaces across the country is falling. And the statistics and the research show evidence of that. That's the way it's going. So... if you go and ban something, you're encouraging people to breach that ban. And that's what happened in the past in relation to it. There is no need to bring in a ban in relation to domestic turf whatsoever. The issue is in relation to smoky coal, and that's where the focus needs to be.
I thought the Taoiseach's performance and the government's performance on this is a bit strange, to be honest. They've been delaying. In recent times, and now they're going out for a public consultation in relation to... But, like, I mean, I think it's just kicking it to touch, really. I also thought it was strange was the Taoiseach putting it back on Fianna Fáil and saying, you're trying to ban burning peat and wood and all the rest of it. Which I just thought was very strange, given what he had just done of launching a public consultation. Look, I think... it is the case that these things are going to be phased out. But, like, I mean, the reality is people who burn turf, people who burn wood, they're not wealthy people, generally speaking. Yeah. Like, I mean, there has to be incentives and support to ensure that people have the opportunity
to transition. Okay, I'm going to have to take my last break, but stay with us. We'll try and get a word in about RTE after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, today, RTE's Director General Dee Forbes was before an Oireachtas committee where she was arguing that a delay of 7 years for the introduction of a media charge is completely untenable for the organisation. And, of course, we heard today as well that the government is to increase funding to the tune of 10 million and that a commission on the future of broadcasting is being established. Dennis Nocton, you seem to have been the minister for everything that we were talking about tonight.
He's to blame.
When you were in that department, was this on your desk and was it a priority?
Absolutely, it was on my desk, and it went the whole way to the top of government. I think people tend to kick it back down. I think people tend to forget the report that Martin Fraser produced in terms of the Strategic Communications Unit, where he made it very clear that the issue of a public service broadcasting, particularly in terms of news content, required significant investment and required public investment in it. And it is being airbrushed by everyone, by RTE and everyone out of existence at the moment. And that is a key issue for us here in Ireland and right across Europe now. How do we ensure that you have reliable quality news content, not just in RTE, but in any of the other news outlets, whether it be print, digital or broadcast media?
Colette, Pat Leahy was writing about this when the RTE plan was unveiled a short while ago, and basically said that nobody in government has a good word to say about RTE, and most politicians, as he said, not just in government, but most politicians don't have a good word to say about RTE, and describe scenarios where ministers were saying that, you know, people sitting in seats like myself, they just want to go out, they're out to get you.
Yeah.
Is that a problem? Is that it's politically unpopular to suggest funding RTE? And it's actually internally politically unpopular.
I think it's unpopular everywhere. I don't think anybody relishes paying the licence charge every year, and the level of evasion actually of payment of the charge is probably indicative of that. Politicians don't like journalists generally, particularly journalists who tend to be asked them a lot of awkward questions. And for the public service broadcaster, RTE has a long list of very good news programmes, which, you know, generally do their best to hold the government to account, which won't win you many favours in government service. So that is a bit of a problem. I thought it was interesting today that the Taoiseach stood up and said, seemed to indicate that there was some kind of quid pro quo for the 10 million in extra funding that RTE were getting, which was hastily denied by Dee Forbes.
The Lyric FM deferment.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to cut you off short. We will obviously be coming back to talk about this again. Just time to say that tonight's programme was produced by Regina Henley. Research was by Abby Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Nikki Dempsey was on sound. I want to thank my panel here tonight and now hand over to Colm Murray on Late Date.